Affairs. Today is January 15th, 2009. I'd like to start with the traditional reminder that in this room, cell phones, Blackberries, PDAs, any type of device of a similar nature does interfere with our recording equipment. So I know it's difficult, but I'd like to ask you to actually turn those off during the time that we're here today, and I appreciate that so much. Thank you. We are going to start with an introduction, because this is not only the first meeting of the session, but also the first meeting of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. I would like to just start with an introduction of the committee members, committee staff, and committee administrator. And I would like you to, I'll give Senator Przanski credit for starting this morning. Tell us a little something about yourself. What do you do when you're not in the legislature? And also let us know for the committee members a little bit about your district, where it is located. And I'll go ahead and start. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is the northeast corner of Washington County and the northwest corner of Multnomah County. I'm new in the Senate, served in the 2000 session in the House, and when I am not in the legislature, I used to practice law and took a career break and became a public education advocate, and I very much look forward to this session as chair of this new committee in the Senate. Look forward to working with you all. You want to start, Senator Burdick?
Okay. I'm Ginny Burdick, and I've been around here a very long time. In fact, I just hired the daughter of a friend of mine, which really makes you feel old. Anyway, I have been in the Senate since 1997, and I've been on mainly active in Judiciary Committee for the previous sessions, and then took a big change about a year and a half ago, and I now chair the Senate Revenue Committee. And I must say the attendance here, Madam Chair, is twice what we had in revenue today. So I guess that tells you about the interest level. In my day job, I do public relations crisis management, which I find is a very good fit for a lot of what happens around here.
Thank you. Vice Chair George.
Larry George. I represent Senate District 13, which is a gerrymandered district, so it goes from Gaston, reaches across Washington County, grabs all rural areas, Sherwood and Wilsonville, Newburgh, and Kaiser. So it goes all the way down the south. And outside of the legislature, I am a food processor. We process hazelnuts.
Thank you very much. Senator Girard.
I'm Fred Girard. I represent Senate District 9, which really, for this side of the mountains, is a huge district. If you went to Donald and Aurora up through Estacada, go to the summit, and then you go past the San Ian Pass down to the McKenzie Pass, and south of Sweet Home in Lebanon, and then zig and zag on the way up. I have 17 little cities. Smallest is Waterloo, which is a little over 200, and the biggest is Lebanon. Basically, I do some dentistry, I work with assisted care facilities, and I do some development.
Thank you. Our other member is Senator Rosenbaum, and we'll have her introduce herself when she arrives. And our committee administrator, Lori Brocker.
I'm Lori Brocker. When I'm not here at session, I'm an attorney, and I don't represent anyone, I guess, other than committee services here, but I'm from Southwest Portland, and Senator Burdick is my senator. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm glad that somebody talked about my district. I forgot.
Thank you. And Senator Rosenbaum, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Senator Bonamici.
We're doing introductions.
And
if you could tell us a little bit about your district and what you do when you're not in the legislature.
I'm Senator Diane Rosenbaum, and I am in my first term in the Senate and representing Southeast Portland, Northeast Portland, and now part of Clackamas County, Milwaukee. I apologize for being late. I told Senator Burdick that I was trying to be in the Revenue Committee like a good kid on the first day of class by being right on time, so that if I was late again, everybody would think I was always on time. And so now I've established that I'm a bad kid in consumer protection. So I have been 10 years in the House of Representatives. I'm very excited to be now on the Senate side. working on consumer protection issues, which I think are crucial in these tough economic times. And when I'm not here, which seems like I'm always here right now, I like to canoe and go sailing.
Thank you so much, Senator. And our committee staff, would you please introduce yourselves? It looks like you're trying to resolve something over there.
Hi, I'm Ann Martin. I'm a committee assistant, and this will be my seventh session, but I haven't been here for 6 years.
Welcome back. Thank you. We have an order of business to take care of today, and that's the adoption of the committee rules, and those have been distributed by the committee administrator. Does anybody have any questions about them? It's my understanding that the main change from last session is that now we have the fiscal and or revenue impact statement prior to reporting a bill out of committee. We adopted these this morning in Judiciary in basically the same form. Does anybody have any questions about the rules? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated January 15, 2009.
Are there any objections? The committee rules are adopted. And I will now open an informational meeting. What I've done today to start out our committee is I've asked for an update on the implementation of the Oregon Identity Theft Protection Act. This is a bill that we passed, Senate Bill 583, in 2007. I know many of you in the room were very much involved in the drafting and the passage of that bill. And what I'd like to do is ask for an update on the implementation of the Oregon Identity Theft Protection Act, with a particular emphasis on a section of that bill that required a report back to the legislature at the end of December of 2008 regarding a specific issue, and that is how long it takes for a consumer to remove a freeze on his or her credit report. There are issues of technology that can expedite that process, and we wanted to get an update on how that is working. And we have today with us a representative of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and that is Lou Savage. And David Tappan. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me today is David Tappan. David's the Administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, the division in our agency which enforces and oversees the identity theft program. As the Chair mentioned, Senate Bill 583 was passed by the legislature in the 2007 session. It was a unanimous vote by both chambers, and that is primarily the result of the hard work that was done by a work group that met for nearly a year, and it was composed of consumer groups, industry groups, government agencies, and members of the legislature who attended a number of the meetings. Senator Floyd Prezanski was really the leader of this effort, and I'm sorry he's not here today to thank him, because it was his leadership that resulted in the passage of this bill. We've distributed a packet for your review, and one of the items in the packet is just a summary of the act itself, and one of those provisions is the focus of the chair's inquiry today about the security freeze itself. But just to quickly review, there's really four basic elements to this statute. One is a provision which requires safeguarding of personal information. The second is notification to a consumer if there is a security breach of computer information. The third is the right to the security freeze for any Oregon consumer. And the fourth is a protection of Social Security numbers from display or disclosure. The Act is now a part of the Oregon Revised Statutes. It's found at ORS 646A.600 to 646A.628. And that citation is on the second page of the summary. The purpose of the bill was to make sure that personal information was protected and that consumers knew what their rights were to a security freeze. So with that in mind, the department spent a lot of time preparing materials that it could distribute to the public and then following that up with numerous meetings, town halls, and forums that we've conducted all over the state. A number of legislators have actually taken advantage of that and invited us to town hall meetings, and we've made presentations, and we would be happy to do that again if any members of the committee would like us to do that. And again, in your packet, we've got kind of the two samples that we use when we do these forums and workshops. One is a slender brochure which we have directed primarily to consumers who would like to put a security freeze on their credit file, and the second is the thicker booklet, which is a business guide to businesses. Give them some guidance on how to safeguard personal information that they may have of clients or patients or customers. What we found in the forums and the workshops that we've done is that most businesses were already doing this, and the information that we gave them was useful to tailor the whatever plan they had to protect their clients' personal information. When we started some of these workshops, people were very anxious, but by the time we were through, they understood that, in fact, this was good business practice, and most of them were doing this anyway. We've conducted about 150 or 60 workshops throughout the state, everywhere from Ashland to Pendleton. We've done numerous workshops in Portland, Salem, and Eugene. And again, whether you or any of the groups that you work with would be interested in having us conduct a workshop, we'd be happy to do that. David, is there anything that you wanted to add on that?
Just a couple things. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the two brochures we have before you are certainly available for you and your constituents. We would encourage you, if you want us to present them to you and have a stack on hand, that's great. We also have that on our website, so people contacting us would naturally find that there. Because we were given this responsibility, because as a regulatory agency, we know so much about going out and starting new programs. That's a poor joke. The reality is we don't know a lot about it, and it was a really daunting task for us. And I have to tip my hat to our staff at the Department of Consumer Business Services that put this together. Particularly the business brochure has been outstanding. It's very readable, and it's very simple to comprehend. One of the questions we get a lot is, well, just tell us what we need to do. And, of course, we can't do that because it's going to differ between the 7-Eleven on one corner and the law firm in downtown Portland, what the responsibilities are, what type of data you're capturing, and so forth. So we try and make that clear. And that's one of the beautiful things about this law, I think, is that it does allow for some flexibility given the nature and size of a particular business. So I just want to echo what Lou said. These are available, we're available to go out and do that. Both Mr. Savage, Lou, and myself have gone out and given presentations. We have a specialist in our division that does that. And then I'll kick it back over to Lou, but I have some additional information about complaints we've received and so forth, and I'm sure you'd like to hear about that.
Thank you.
One of the reasons this bill was very well received in the legislature was the work that was done, as I mentioned earlier, And it was the product of compromise. The key players were at the table. We spent a lot of time talking about these issues. And where we needed to compromise, we did that. And one of those areas was the security freeze and the amount of time that a credit reporting agency would have to either freeze a file after it was notified by a consumer or lift the freeze temporarily if a consumer, say, froze their file, then they wanted to go to Macy's and open up a credit card, open up a credit account. So they would be able to unfreeze the file for a certain period of time so that Macy's could check their credit and then issue them a credit card. So when those notifications came from the consumer, the law provides for a period of time within which the credit reporting agency needed to respond. We talked about what that time period should be. We settled on 5 days for the initial freeze, 3 days to unfreeze the file or to thaw the file. And then the law, the bill provided for DCBS to come back in 2 years to determine to provide information so that the legislature could determine whether that period of time should be shortened based upon improvements in the technology. So as the bill provided, we have prepared a report, and David will summarize that. And again, that report is in your packet as well.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that report should have a cover letter to the Senate President and the designated Speaker of the House, and then the reports below that. I think if you want to just jump right to the heart of it, page 3 shows you how the different states have addressed these issues of the time frame. And you can see we're approximately right in the middle of where most of the other states are and very consistent. The issue really came up at the legislative process in 2007 because one state, I believe it was Utah, but it could be corrected on that, was trying to implement a 15-minute period from the time a request to the time action had to be taken. And nobody was certain if that was doable or not, so we looked to our neighboring states and trying to find a good meeting ground. What we understand is you get to the end, we've got information from the three credit reporting companies, TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax, and rather than go through that in great deal, you certainly can read that, how their processes take place. But what we understood from Equifax as we were preparing this report is they are in the process of arriving at the place where they think they can do at least the temporary lifting as opposed to a permanent removal of a freeze within 15 minutes. And so we go on to identify that last chapter, the pluses and minuses of the length of time involved, depending on your perspective. And we understand that there may be some concerns that if you lift something too quickly, that could result in an erroneous action being taken or could result in harm that was trying to be prevented. Alternatively, though, we understand also that a lot of people need to have these things lifted on a rather quick period of time, and if you need to buy a battery that day or you need to buy tires that day because of something that just took place and you have to wait 3 days, that could be a major detriment. So those are the competing issues we think that have to be balanced out here, and I would recommend you talk to the industry itself and their representatives to find out how doable that is. So we basically just identified it, teed it up, and now give it to you to do that. I did want to talk, if I could, just for a moment on our role in complaints and so forth. As the agency charged with this, our primary, in fact, other than the rollout process and the preparation of education and information, our responsibility has been to take complaints and follow through with investigations as needed. And we've provided you a one-page summary. It says outreach summary 2007-2008. And in the year 2008, when we really had the program up and running, we received 37 complaints. Most of the complaints were dealt with as educational opportunity. We don't feel it's our primary responsibility to take a heavy stick and beat someone about the head and shoulders, especially with a new law coming out of the box. In fact, most of the time, these were due to mistakes or due to oversight. And I would say half the time the complaints didn't even fall under the jurisdiction or under the law itself. Many times what there was being complained of did not pertain to electronic data, but maybe it was print data. So we've taken this opportunity to educate and inform both consumers and businesses about the need for that. It's something that naturally falls to us because we do this as a serious part of our regulatory role in banks, credit unions, mortgage lenders, and securities dealers, among others, to make sure that they're taking care of this. So we do not go out and inspect, obviously, every person, every business out there. We don't have the jurisdiction nor the staffing to do that. So we basically are reactive rather than going out and doing examinations. But I think given the number and the fact that we didn't find any serious violations to date, I think that shows that that's about where we should be in terms of the process for handling the enforcement. And with that, I'll conclude and take any questions you might have.
Thank you. I'll start with a question to either of you, Mr. Tapman or Mr. Savage. Do you happen to know if the other states that have the 15-minute time frame, I noticed in your handout both Idaho and Washington, and if my recollection is correct, the other state is Utah. Has that been working well for them? Have they seen problems with that 15 minutes via electronic method of thaw?
Madam Chair, I don't have any information on that. We've not heard. I can ask the individual who did the initial inquiry if he received anything anecdotal. I'm not aware of that. We can do a little search on the internet too, if that would be something you'd like us to follow up on.
A couple, Madam Chair, in a couple of these states, it really is fairly recently that this has been implemented, even though the law passed, you know, a couple of years ago. So I'm not sure how much information they would have, but it's certainly something we could follow up on.
Thank you, and I think I'm going to ask Mr. Markey to respond to that. Any questions of Mr. Tapman or Mr. Savage?
Madam Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to know, I've always wanted to know, and now I see it here, why it's important to throw away or to shred credit card offers. I've looked at these offers, and they don't have Social Security numbers or account numbers, and I've always wondered about that. Why would that be?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I think, first of all, it's just a good, prudent practice, anything that comes from a financial services company, to shred. It in this day and age, and I'm not an expert in this area, but there are a number of ways of composing an identity from different components, and whether it's name and address, or name, date of birth, or other components, I've heard that people don't necessarily need both a Social Security number or even a credit card identification number to backtrack or find ways to get into the internet using certain data and then compose that fake identity to create havoc. So I think it's more of a prudence than if you don't do it, someone will immediately take advantage of it.
Okay, Madam Chair, and to follow up, if you put a freeze on your credit rating, would that stop all the credit card offers?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I wish I could tell you yes. What the freeze does is prohibits anyone from getting credit in your name. That's really the function. So if that happens, any personal information that they would get from you would be useless for getting credit in your name.
But someone could still do a credit check on. I didn't think they could even do a credit check on you, like for a mortgage or something like that.
Well, and I should have brought the statute with me, but there are certain instances where an organization or an agency can get information from the credit reporting agency. David, are you?
No, I think that's correct.
Yeah.
So they can still get the information, but
well, it really depends upon what entity you're talking about.
Okay. And to follow up, Madam Chair, and I was on this committee, but not last session, so I'm way behind the eight ball here. Do you publish a list of? Because I'm a person who might be inclined to just put a freeze on the darn thing and not have to worry about it. But if you say you can't even buy a cell phone battery, I mean, do you publish a list of things that you should be aware of before you freeze your credit? In other words, things you won't be able to do?
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, I think the place I'd refer you to first is just starting out with this brochure that talks about essentially the pros and cons of, mm-hmm. of doing just
okay.
that. It
we'll
identifies
take a closer
it, this is not just an automatic, well, I'm just going to put a freeze on it and everything's going to be golden from this day forward. It really points out just what you said. There's a drawback to that, and you may not be able to get something you need in the time you need. And as Mr. Savage pointed out, there are certain areas, and I believe it was landlord-tenant type areas and things of that nature, where people can obtain that information even if there is a freeze, just so commerce doesn't grind to a halt in certain areas.
Okay. And final follow-up, Madam Chair. I was one of the people who took advantage of your educational opportunities, and you did an excellent job, you know, with a
Good.
Town hall that I had. But I was wondering about your outreach to the business community, because there are pretty serious requirements for business to keep information you know, protected. And what kind of outreach? Are you working through the associations, or how are you doing that?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, most of our outreach has actually been to the business community, chambers of commerce, you know, city clubs, various business associations. I've done several presentations to CPA organizations, the Bar Association, continuing legal education. So we've tried to hit the business communities in the you know, statewide, so that those folks are aware of their obligations. And certainly, if there's any associations that any members of the committee think ought to hear about this, we would check to see whether we have already given a presentation to them, and if not, we would certainly be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Senator Girard, I saw you first, and then Senator
okay.
Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Chair. The question I would have, and you're looking at somebody that's had his identification stolen twice, and it's been by hackers hacking into Citibank. And so the question being, first of all, with the information world the way that it is, what all do you see besides this bill that we can do to prevent such things as identification theft through hacking? I don't see any solution to this, and it really kind of bothers me, because I got to tell you, I was eating dinner and I went to pay my bill, and I just found out about $200 worth of lingerie in New York. So, so a bit of an eye opener, and I had to explain things a little bit. But plus, I had to pay cash for my dinner. So, I mean, this is a huge, huge problem, and this is kind of the tip of the iceberg, and we're kind of going after the low-hanging fruit here. But a lot of the problem is just is hackers and rings hacking into right. major lists, and like I said, mine were all. It was both in New York, so.
Chair Buonamici, Senator Girard, you're right. This is just one little piece of the problem. There's a crime of cyber theft. I don't know if I frankly don't know if there's a state statute that makes cyber theft a crime. I know on the federal level there is. So the example that you've given certainly would not be covered by an identity theft statute. It would be a criminal statute that would address cyber theft.
And Madam Chair, Senator Girard, I would echo what Mr. Savage says. Anecdotally, I just found out yesterday I've been hacked for the third time. And I just found out I was at a racetrack in Florida mm-hmm. placing bets this week while I was actually here in Salem. So it's very frustrating, and frankly, this is only to try and assist the consumer. This doesn't really get at the problem. This is to make businesses mindful and take steps to prevent glaring mistakes in transportation or making sure they lock things up. A conscious decision to get in there and hack is just what Mr. Savage says. That's criminal conduct. I believe there is state. I know there's federal. I know the FBI is. This is a high-level priority. But I think that's part of this brave new world we're in, where the crooks are ahead of law enforcement right now. And I don't know that anyone here, in the state of Oregon can address something of that magnitude. It seems to be a national problem.
Just a follow-up.
Sure.
If they are caught, because it just seems like the effort to try to catch these people seems to be somewhat minimal. It really does. And if they are caught, what kind of federal... what are they looking at as far as crime goes, as far as punishment?
Madam Chair, Senator Dry, I don't know. I don't know the magnitude. I do know if they're being prosecuted federally, they're probably doing time, and usually it's two-thirds, if not the whole sentence.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is really wanting to know a little more about the notification process when there is a breach. Just reading the summary, it sounds kind of vague that there are all many different ways that you can be notified by telephone, electronically, or in writing. And so maybe you could talk a little more about that process. I got one of these notifications, and I'm just curious if there's sort of a standard that you have laid out of this is what a notification should look like and whether contact information for the agency needs to be included in that notification.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, we really did in the statute give the business some choices as to how to notify, and that was partly because one size really does not fit all. I mean, there are businesses that have so few customers or clients that they can literally pick up the phone and call every one of them, and the statute provides that if they do that, they have to make personal contact. They can't just leave a voicemail on your telephone. There are other circumstances where the business would want to send a letter directly to the client or the customer, and then the third option is if it is such a huge population, we are allowing an alternative form of communication if it meets a standard for either dollar amount, you know, how much it's going to cost the business to do the notification, or the number of people that need to be notified. So yes, the choice for communication is really the businesses to make. Once the consumer is notified, then they make the choice as to whether they whether they want to request a security freeze.
Just to follow up, so it just seems like if you do a telephone notification, there's really no way to ensure that conversation took place. And I'm not sure if you were calling an elderly person, for instance, or even a my age person who doesn't always pay a lot of attention. It just doesn't seem like that would be the best method of notifying people. When I got one of these letters, it was from one of my healthcare providers, and it took me quite by surprise, and it said, we have had a breach. We don't believe that this is going to create a problem, but basically, if you believe that there is a problem, just call us. And so at least I had something in writing that I could hold on to and then refer back to. But if it's a telephone call, it's sort of a much more ephemeral kind of communication, it seems like.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, that discussion, we spent a lot of time talking about that issue in the work group, and there were arguments on all sides of that issue. I mean, a number of people said that a telephone call was better because it was a direct contact with the person, and if they got a letter in the mail, they may or may not open it because it was from, you know, some business, and maybe they thought it was a solicitation. We didn't require anything on the outside of the envelope. So yeah, you raise a good point. What I think was convincing to a lot of people who sat around the table, including the consumer groups, was that it is really in the business's interest to make sure that its customers and clients know about the breach. Putting aside the fact that our agency can fine them if they don't comply with the statute, the potential public relations mess that they would see if there was a breach and people found out that later on, through some other source, that their personal information was breached. The potential financial harm from that was probably greater than any other deterrent that we could come up with.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I think that the fact that we've discovered that there are victims of identity theft not only on the committee but with the DCBS as well just shows you the extent of the problem. Is there any way for you to determine, or do you have a sense of whether people who are putting freezes on their credit reports are paying for the prevention, or are they the people who have been victims and therefore have the right to put it on without a fee?
Madam Chair, we have not followed up with that. I think the impression we're leaving is that we haven't done a number of things, and I'll be candid with you, that was by design. This is really a non-regulatory response. We don't go out. We don't require people to send us a copy of everything they send to their customers, because then government would be checking on every step of the way. We don't go out. We have no authority to go in and examine and make sure these safeguards are in place. So what we are is a repository for complaints, and we will follow up to determine if things were done properly or improperly. And that's about as far as we go. We don't feel like it's our responsibility, and frankly, we're neither funded nor staffed to do just that. So we could follow up on certain questions and find that out, but we do not maintain much of a research aspect to this program.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, let me just follow up on what David said. We do not charge a fee to every business in the state of Oregon, even though every business is required to comply with the Identity Theft Protection Act. So we have to strike a balance between enough of a presence so that there is a deterrent, but not have a huge program that would require some source of revenue to be able to do a wide-sweeping monitoring of the law.
Well, it looks like you've done an admirable job getting the word out there about the provision, so I thank the department for that. Any other questions of these two? I'm going to ask Jim Marquis to come up and just answer the question as best as he can about the 15-minute provision. I know he may have information on that. Thank you. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I thought it might be helpful to get some information if you have it about the 15-minute, the states that have the 15-minute provision to remove the freeze on the credit report. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you for asking me up. I'm Jim Marquis. I represent TransUnion, one of the three credit reporting agencies nationally that are involved in this. TransUnion actually offered the credit freeze to everyone in all states prior to this law coming into effect. I worked on the work group, and frankly, we asked for 3 days on the thaw because at the time we were developing software to do what needed to be done as quickly as we could, but it was an emerging technology and we were trying to figure out how to do it. So we asked for 3 days in all cases and agreed to have this look-see at in a couple of years as to where we were at. TransUnion is, as I think all of the agencies are, really thawing a freeze in a matter of seconds if the request comes electronically, if the customer remembers their PIN number, and for every 1,000 people that freeze their file, there's about 3 that can remember their PIN number, so keep that in mind. Obviously, an exaggeration, but there are times when there are simply you don't have the information, or you're looking and something doesn't feel right, and you want to take a little extra time before you thaw this frozen credit file, and we think that's important. In the normal course of events, it's simply happening if the request comes electronically in a matter of seconds, and it just doesn't cause any problems. To my knowledge, TransUnion itself hasn't had any complaints on the credit freeze from anybody in Oregon, and I really can't speak to other states in terms of they've got 15 minutes and is that a problem? I don't think it's a problem. If it's, and I haven't read those statutes, but I think that the 15 minutes only refers to electronic requests. If the request comes by mail, we need 3 days. So, you know, that because you'd have to back and forth. So, our position on this whole issue is that there's probably no need for a change in the law because in the normal course of events, people are getting the, if they're at the car dealer trying to buy a car or whatever it is, they make the request and it gets thawed. So it's just not, as far as we know, not a problem. But if you have that one case where you're concerned or you think there may be something askance, then you might want to take a little extra time. And I don't think that this committee wants to force credit reporting agencies into a situation where they have to act quickly even in those situations. So that would be, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. McKee? Senator Dredd.
Thank you. What a bumbler here. I would just like to kind of say that when I got my identification stolen, and this was with the bank, it wasn't with a reporting agency, but I told you that the credit card was canceled right there. They had to confirm that I was the legitimate guy. Yeah. Because somebody was ringing up bills in New York. So I think, in all honesty, you got to give people a little bit of time. I think 15 minutes seems a little excessive to me to weed out who's right, who's wrong, and what the answers are. That's not to say that he can't do it faster in 3 days, but 15 minutes seems a little bit... I'd be afraid that somebody would have all the right information and... even though this is a credit reporting agency, that something wrong could be done. So I'd rather be a little bit safe, cause a little bit more inconvenience, than to have another $50,000 rung up in my name somewhere else. That's just kind of a personal observation of someone that I am really fed up with having my identification stolen.
I hope it doesn't happen again, Senator.
Madam Chair, if I could just respond momentarily to Senator Burdick's question regarding exceptions to the freeze and what you can and can't do. The freeze, when you freeze your credit file, the work group really came to the conclusion that what we needed to do was to allow people to freeze their credit file as to someone trying to get credit through the use of that file. So inquiries as to credit are frozen and halted, and the file is closed to all those kinds of inquiries. But as to if you're trying to rent an apartment and a landlord is looking, or there's some other reason that's not related to the extension of credit, then those bona fide business customers of the credit reporting agency do have access to the file. And that's pretty much universal across the nation in these laws.
So, Madam Chair, so okay. But what about the cell phone thing? I mean, can they get access or not if you go to buy a cell phone battery or a cell phone?
Well, that wasn't my.
They're not really.
That wasn't my
credit.
Scenario. I mean, if you're trying to buy something on credit. If you were not going to, if you weren't going to pay cash for the cell phone battery, you want to put it on your credit card, if you want to pay cash or make payment, and somebody wanted to check your credit relative to that transaction, mm-hmm. they would not have access to your file.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do they check your credit every time you use a credit card?
No, they don't.
Oh, if you're opening an account.
But if you were going to open a new account or that sort of thing, they might, yeah. So if they're going to check your credit in a transaction, regarding a transaction where you're seeking the extension of credit, if they're going to look at your file for that, they can't do it.
Right.
And so, so we have 5 days to freeze if somebody requests the freeze, and we have 3 days to thaw it out. But in the normal course of events, it's just a matter of seconds if the request comes electronically.
Madam Chair, and just a comment, I think people don't realize that their credit is checked for all sorts of things that you would never even think about. In a former life, I provided telephone service for people, and a credit check was done every time somebody got a phone hooked up, and that probably isn't the first thing you would think of when you move into a new apartment and get a phone. So I think, obviously in this climate, when we want people to be protected, but we also want people to be buying things and doing things to stimulate the economy, it's sort of that balancing of you certainly don't want what we've done to be a barrier to people being able to get out there and live their lives and spend their
and
money.
And Madam Chair, Representative Senator Rosenbaum, you're exactly right. And this law really deals with identity theft, and it slows people down considerably who are trying to use people's credit files to steal their identity. But the freeze doesn't really do much at all in terms of somebody getting into somebody's bank account, or I just gave the Department of Justice some letters that were sent to my 90-year-old mother-in-law saying that somebody from the official Department of Census is going to come and see her and request a bunch of personal information, and she lives in a mobile home park that's have a lot of senior citizens, and they just did a mass mailing. They're going to send somebody in. They're going to get a bunch of personal information. So this doesn't do much to stop that kind of stuff. There's always going to be new ways that these people find
I hope
to
the
do
police
this.
Will be there to meet them.
I hope so.
Thank you. And Mr. Marquis, do you have a sense of, I asked the question of the other panel, of the number of people who are putting freezes on their credit reports? Are they people who are doing that as a preventive measure, or are they victims of identity theft?
I don't have, Madam Chair, I don't have those numbers. I think I could probably get the numbers on people who have frozen their files with TransUnion. I wouldn't have that information for the other bureaus, and I'm not sure they would give it to me. They might give it to you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So, but I'd be happy to furnish that to you if you'd like to have that. I'll check and see if that's available.
I think that would be interesting. And if a lot of the requests for a freeze and thaw are done electronically, I'm wondering whether the $10 per credit reporting agency fee is perhaps a burden on senior citizens and people on fixed income if they have to pay $10 for every credit reporting agency when they put it on, and then $10 every time they take it off, and it's all done electronically. Are we looking at something that could be addressed?
Were you suggesting it wasn't enough? Oh, no.
Not what I'm suggesting.
Sorry. I misunderstood. I that's a pretty standard fee across, I think it's almost, well, I think there are a couple of states that are $5, and I think there are some states that are 15. The 10 is pretty universal other than that. So, but certainly, we can have that discussion. And I will try to get the information for you on the number of freezes. I think you're going to be surprised at how few it is. Our experience has been that it's just not very many people actually do this.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I will now close the informational meeting for today and adjourn the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs.
I'm waiting for that blue light to go up.
Fast.